Greetings and salutations, everyone. This, once again, is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I'm net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. The Limark Technical Net has been going strong for 40-plus years. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m. here, we gather together, and we discuss science and technology, share information with each other, teach each other, learn from each other, and have a good time. It's all meant in the best of spirits. I hope no one gets into arguments or disputes or has high blood pressure due to any of it. So, let me drop for a second, and I will tell you the list of usual links that you should be aware of. Okay. Mailbag questions. Those are questions that you can't reach us here on the repeater. So you email it to me, and we treat it like a question that comes in through the repeater. So that's a mailbag question. Or if you have a topic. Now, some people have topics that they would like to present on the technical net. Others would like to be involved in discussions of a given topic. Others would just like to sit there and listen to other people talk about a topic. So you can suggest a topic and what part you want to play with it. Also, we always are looking for technical puzzles. They're surprisingly not easy to find. I particularly try to look for ones where Googling the answer will get you the wrong answer or no answer, which is kind of difficult, but they're still out there, and I'm still looking. So if you have any good technical puzzles, please send them along. Also, if you would like me to tap all WS2N on the shoulder and have them take a look at a space or NASA-related story and comment on it, for any of these reasons, my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Of course, if you want to contact Paul directly, he's available. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. We have a link page. All kinds of interesting articles, YouTube, what have you, that I've seen over the past week. Are available. I keep that link page up 24/7, so any old time you want to take a look at them, feel free. You get there by typing into the browser, roy.ac2gs.com. There's a chat room available. Sometimes it's active, sometimes it's not so active, but if you're interested, type into your browser, chat.ac2gs.com, and you have access to the chat room. We have an audio stream I set up of W2VL for people who are out of the area and don't have EchoLink. By the way, EchoLink is down, unfortunately, tonight. So if you want to listen into the audio stream, you just type into your browser, technet.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to my audio stream. And I try and keep it available 24/7. So keep that in mind. And I always want to remind people of my KC2NJI has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv. It has archives of the technical net going as far back as September of 2006. So with that, let me drop for a second, and I'll tell you what I got planned for you. Okay. It's a regular flavored TechNet tonight. Unfortunately, no guest speakers, no puzzles, but I'm always looking for them for both. So it'll just be a matter of asking people if they have any questions or comments or topics that they would like to discuss and putting them down in order and trying to address them as best we can. We'd like to keep the early questions related to amateur radio, although ultimately down the line tonight we'll address any kind of realistic, scientific, technological topic. And as always, we do not treat nor diagnose medical problems, but we can discuss them. So we're going to be doing that until about 10:15, and Paul will come on and do the SpaceNet report, and that'll take us to approximately 11 p.m. And I will return and put a ribbon on it and wish you all a good week and call it a TechNet. So that's the plan for tonight. If the universe allows me, the propagation conditions, repeater conditions, my radio conditions, and everything else that goes into this technical net. So, with that in mind, if there's anyone out there who has any questions or comments or topics, please hit that push to talk and give me your first name and your call sign.
82OGB, and I certainly have something.
Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu.
Craig and Rich recognized. Welcome aboard, people. Anyone else want to put their name down? We had a problem last week. Gentleman Taylor put his name down third, and the way the TechNet sometimes works, we ran out of time. So, Taylor, if you're out there, we'll kick you up to the first position if you're out there and have your question from last week. Okay, I guess Taylor either hasn't tuned in yet or is doing something else tonight. One more request, one more attempt. Of course, we'll have opportunities as the night progresses to add your name to our list. But if you'd like to add it right now, if you have a question or a comment for tonight, please give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, we tried. We'll try again later on. Craig, KD2OGB, what's your question or your comment for tonight?
Let me get some comments in before my question. So, currently doing some work on my Jeep, trying to get a third radio installed, and it's actually going pretty well. My wires on both battery terminals without actually disconnecting them. There's actually three nuts that hold the terminals in place, and where the wires are for my other radios, I just had to remove only one of those nuts just to get the wire on. I did negative first and then positive. Now I'm just trying to figure out a good place to get the radio and to, you know, make it nice, clean, and tidy.
Okay.
Now, don't really at this point need it anymore, but I'm going to have it come in anyway, so in case I do need to do something with my battery, it's at least safe. So, when I went to install my HF rig a couple of weeks ago, a friend of ours, all we did was disconnect the next terminal of the battery for not even 3 minutes just to flip the wires on. The terminal itself, actually, not like the bolts where the wires for my other radios go. And the car drove. However, is it true that if you usually disconnect either side of the battery, you would lose the keep alive memory without external power?
Yeah, that's the way these things work, unless they happen to have built-in emergency little batteries that keep its memory alive. If you drop out the positive or the negative, you need both, then the memory circuits, which are always kind of refreshing themselves, stop doing that and the memory gets corrupted.
Hands are full here, just had to move something. All right, very good. Because I kind of did a little research, and if you don't have it disconnected for that long, I think it should be okay, but I think if it's like more than 5 or 10 minutes, then I think the memory will drop out from there. But yeah, we disconnected it for not even 3 minutes, and the memory was still there for some reason.
Again, it depends on the design. The most bulletproof design is to have something like a replaceable small battery that kind of takes over. A lot of times what cheaper and easier solutions is to simply put a capacitor in line so that it charges it up, because sometimes these memory chips don't really require a great deal of electricity to maintain their memory. So what then you're playing with is the discharge rate of the capacitor. The more microfarads the capacitor has, the longer before the RC constant is going to bring the voltage potential below the level that the refresh cycles will tolerate, and so you'll have a little bit of a chance. So most likely what you're dealing with is simply a discharge of a capacitor that's kind of holding a charge for a few minutes, just in case.
Comment.
Yes, someone wants to comment. I think it's Rich, but I might be wrong.
This is K2GJE.
Oh, okay, Ed. I knew I got it wrong. Yes, Ed. Please, comment.
He lucked out. It varies from brand to brand and year to year. But if you really want to play it safe, they sell a little gadget that you plug into the cigarette lighter. I don't know if it just has a 9-volt battery or something like that. Evidently, that's enough to keep the memories alive. When you disconnect either negative or positive, you usually lose the clock and you lose the presets in the radio. And these modern cars have too many onboard computers. A friend of mine and his Cadillac had to go back to Cadillac and they had to do some reprogramming. He had window problems and other things like that. He lucked out, over.
Yes, I agree with you, Ed. So Craig lucked out. He got under the window, if you will, of the charging the capacitor that had some degree of a charge. You should kind of make it a practice, if you're ever going to remove the power from your car, to have some kind of a temporary failsafe so that you don't have to reset your electronics. I know of a friend that unfortunately did that, and what it does, among other things, it screws a lot of different things up, because you have to understand that your car is pretty much a computer these days. But one of the things is that it adjusts the parameters for the engine, and it has a feedback system. So it kind of learns and relearns how to optimize the exhaust production. Now, if you just pull the power and then put it back, it goes back to factory reset. If you were to take it in for your inspection, you would most likely fail your inspection because it wouldn't be optimizing the exhaust. You'd kind of fail. So my friend had to drive all over the place in order to give the engine and the computer time to relearn what the best parameters were before he could pass the exhaust portion of the registration. So, as Ed mentioned, always a good idea. I haven't looked, but my guess is Amazon sells something like that, where it's just basically a plug-in to your, the battery plug-in thing for accessories, and you used to be a cigarette lighter, and a simple battery would probably suffice, just so that you don't have to take any chances.
82 OGB. I do have the a 12 volt external battery coming on Tuesday, along with the OBD connector to it, just in case I do need to keep the battery out for a minute. Know for a fact I'm going to lose all that memory, I at least have it. But I'm looking at my car right now. I stopped because I'm on the radio and I hear a train coming. But yeah, I was able to get these cables onto the terminals without actually removing them. All I just had to do was remove a nut holding the wires for my other radios and just slip it right on. And when I went to go clip my wires at the other end, I realized they were literally touching. There was that protector, and I stopped for a second to almost not get a spark, and I cut one at a time. Because if they sparked, that probably would not be good.
Yeah, that wouldn't be good at all. You don't. The sparks are not good things to have. But just make sure that you have a nice, secure connection. Usually, that washer is there for a purpose, to apply a uniform pressure to all the wires and such. But you know, make sure that it's good, and most likely it has one of those delightful little rubber covers, so that you're not exposing the two poles of the battery in case something falls when you have the hood up and such. So, you know, return it to the way that you found it and certainly keep it as spark-free as humanly possible.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'm going to, in a couple of minutes, Velcro my CB somewhere and then just get it hooked up to the battery. One more thing, Roy, and this is just only a comment, and I'd like your opinion. The horn that I currently am holding in my hand, despite I finally got my other one that's 100 watts, and this one maybe only puts out 20, I turned on the volume. I used jumper cables to do a temporary install, and I had the megaphone facing a little bit. This thing is like only 5 inches, and I did a voice check with it, and I could be heard almost all the way down the block. What do you think of that?
I think it's a good take. That's, I assume, what you want to do. Most of the time, if anyone kind of looks at their radio receiver and doesn't realize it, most of the sound that you hear is not these 100 watts. The purpose that hi-fi fans will often tell you is you want the extra headroom for the peaks that are rarely there. So you're not blasting everyone with the 100 watts that your radio is capable of outputting to your speakers. You're just adding to the headroom so that the dynamic range is more normal and reproduces it with more fidelity. But, you know, 20 watts actually is a lot of audio sound, as you noticed.
Maybe I might not put in the amp and other speakers just yet. Maybe I'll just work with this. I mean, I could do a sound check with that, but I'm going to probably need to go somewhere like a parking lot because it's going to be quite loud, and I don't want to make the whole block upset. One more question. Where would it be a good idea to mount this small PA horn that I'm holding in my hand in the front of my grill somewhere? Because I'm looking, and I'm seeing this little, this rough surface, I guess. I assume it's probably the radiator, and I'm seeing these little metal things, and they do actually get hot. I don't know if it would be safe to put the horn over there. And I don't really want it close to the battery, but I want it somewhere in the hood so I can at least hear it. KD2OGB.
Yeah, I would probably keep it away any kind of thermal dissipation system, things with fins and such, because, you know, you're producing even more heat there, so you're countering the benefit of it. So I would find a place that does not have heat sinks and such dissipating your engine's heat. Anyone else out there, because I certainly am not an auto mechanic, have any better ideas of where Craig could place his sound horn?
Usually on an inner fender.
WS, turn about the battery.
Yes, I just want to mention, Ed mentioned the fender. The big question I have is, are you planning to place this horn external to the car, or are you planning to kind of stick it someplace inside where there's enough holes that you think the sound will go through them?
Well, I think I got an idea. I could stick it all the way at the bottom, I guess, where this radiator is, under, I guess, where my grill is, because there's like holes, but I don't really want it jerking around at all, and I don't know if it kind of gets hot under there. I'd have to drive around for 10 to 15 minutes and then feel it and see if it would be safe to put it under there and then try to find a way to get the wire all the way around through my firewall and into the radio. Remember, this is a PA system.
Okay, I'm still not quite sure. I still think it's inside your car. I just want to make sure. This is not that you're strapping it to the outside of your car. You're trying to place it somewhere inside the body of your car.
I was thinking of maybe putting it under the car. And by the way, I think the link is hiccuping again. I thought of putting it under the car because when I was at Firestone for my realignment, which I'm not going into right now because I'm not very happy. I was trying to look under where I could maybe put the horn and then just run the wire upward and then into where my other radios are.
I think if you have clearance to do that ground to that level, that would be a very good idea, because that would obviate any kind of problem of blocking ventilation and thermal dissipation and other stuff. So strapping it right below the bottom of your chassis is, again, as long as you have more than enough clearance where some heavy stone isn't going to crush it. Paul, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, about the battery. Years ago, I had a truck, and I, wanted some radio up inside of that, and I wound up with a marine battery. Not for that purpose. I wanted the marine battery because it could handle heavy discharges, and it was an old truck. And, charge a battery too many times, you're in trouble. With a marine battery, they tend to last forever. If you accidentally discharge it. But one thing I liked about it, on the top it had wing bolts for accessories. Basically it was a marine battery, so you would have it in a boat, and naturally you run accessories. And they made it easy with these wing bolts on top. Now, I'm not recommending to go out and buy a brand new battery, but I'm sure whatever Craig has is good. But since then, I've seen these adapter type of setups that you can mount to the terminals of your batteries that also have wing nuts. So, for like, $6 or $7 each or something. So then you can take any accessories that you have, including radios, and just use the wing nuts. At that point, of course, you don't have to disconnect your battery. You don't have to worry about disconnecting. You just leave everything connected. Just connect things through that wing bolt. And of course, I'm sure you have to have fuses on both positive and negative when you do that. Back to your Roy, WS1.
Yeah, that's a good idea, Paul. By the way, are you using a different radio or a different microphone? Because for some odd reason, a lot of your bass is gone.
I know, you sound a little hollow, so is Craig. But it's the repeater, I guess. I don't have COVID, so it's not my voice. Back to your voice.
Okay, very good. Yeah, things are a little weird here. We're getting Selden tones, I understand, and Echo Link is down, so what can you do? But thank you. So, Craig, any other comments?
Well, I'm looking under my car, and I do not have a jack. I wish I could, to see where would be a really good idea to strap this thing. I'm just going to have to do the radio install only for now. I'll take it out to Riverhead next Saturday, have Darn look, and maybe find a good place to get these speakers hooked up. I mean, I could put it in the hood, but why would I? JD2OGB.
Well, yeah, like I said, if you can find a sturdy place to strap it under the car and you have enough clearance so that there won't be any problem that way, it saves you a lot of problems of overheating the PA system or blocking the ventilation and cooling of engine parts and all kinds of things. Just out of curiosity, not that it's any of my business, is there any particular reason that you think you're going to be needing a PA system in your car?
Not that I would need it, but I figured why not, just to kind of mess with my friends a little bit. Of course, be responsible with it. I want to try something here. Give me a second.
K2STP?
Yes, Fred.
Hi, Roy. How you doing? I just heard you mention the how Paul sounded. I'm just seeing I can, as you know, I can hit both repeaters kind of in the middle, and the Glen Oaks repeater is the one
sounds odd. If I listen on that repeated, you sound a little odd as well. The people that are going through Sheldon sound normal on Sheldon, but if I listen to them on Glen Oaks, they don't sound right. So it's something on Glen Oaks that's a little bit screwy.
I tend to think it's our good friend, The Link. The Link has been problematic for a while now. There's been some discussion of whether some other station, when they transmit, produces intermod distortion, and it drops the Link entirely, but I think now The Link is manifesting strange audio characteristics. So if I was a betting man, which I usually am not, I think it's The Link that's the problem. That's why if you're listening totally on Glen Oaks or totally on Selden, it's probably not a problem. It's when you're going through that darn Link.
K2SDP, it's understood. I'm listening to each repeater separately, the output of from each repeater. Yeah, and I think has had problems. I know they know about it. But this is different. This is the audio coming out of the Glen Oaks repeater. Doesn't sound normal. It's a little bit odd.
Oh, okay. Hopefully, Lou, NY2H, is listening to us. He left me a little note in the chat room, so I assume he's out there someplace listening. So, some further information for you to consider. What would we be without the technical committee? I mean, they fix all these things rather quickly, and so we'll just have to kind of suffer through until once again they're able to fix it. What can we do?
Yeah, and just FYI, Roy, it's not bad. It just sounds different. It's not quite as good as Julius, but you sound fine, so don't worry about it. K2SDP.
Okay, very good. So as long as I can be understood, that's all I ask out of the repeater at this point in time. So thank you, Chris. Thank you for that information. So Craig, are you back from your experiment?
Yeah, I think what I could do, next to the radiator are these little metal things, but they do get pretty hot. What I might do is I can put the metal mount of my to those metal pieces and just make sure that it's too hard, but metal against metal seems to maybe work, but I don't know. I don't think that having the plastic touch the metal, considering it gets hot, would be a smart choice.
Yeah, I mean, you might want to use something that's an insulator that doesn't melt, porcelain, something a little bit with a higher melting point than, say, plastic.
Yeah, what I'm just going to do is I'm going to focus on installing the radio, and it is getting dark outside. I at least have the wires connected, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to put electrical tape on both ends to make sure that they don't spark if they accidentally touch one another. I'll close up shop, and then I'll see what I can do first thing in the morning until, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, and then from there I'll spend the rest of my time getting ready for work.
Okay, sounds like a plan, Craig. I wish you luck. I hope you get a lot of enjoyment out of your additional radio. I don't know if you've ever seen pictures. Occasionally, people put up, I think, somewhat satirically meant pictures where there's basically a large group of transceivers, and it just so happens to include a car. I mean, I don't even know how the driver sits in the thing. If you've ever seen them, they're kind of very popular. There was a website that was dedicated to pictures like that of, the number of radios in his car. You know, you kind of lose track after you counted the 50th transceiver that you could see in the picture.
Yeah, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to secure everything, lock it all up, and continue this project tomorrow morning. So thank you very much for the help and suggestions, Roy. Maybe I even might do a little welcoming when I go to the picnic. But of course, keep it reasonable. I don't want to be laughed at. And with that being said, I think this wraps it up. So I will say sensories and I'm going to go inside. AC2GS.
Okay, very good, Craig. Again, I wish you good luck and thanks for participating. Next on our illustrious list is Rich W2BZ. What's your question or comment for tonight, Rich?
Hello, Roy. Hello, everybody. I am still in Queens, so I'm coming through the Glen Oaks repeater and still babysitting for my daughter's cat. And my daughter is flying home from Paris as we speak, and I am tracking her flight visually. She's at 38,000 feet and going 479 knots over the ground. Talking about keeping tabs on your kids, I mean, I am glad that I am of the age where I still am in total wonderment over these electronic gadgets we now take for granted. I mean, to see her plane and 3D over the ground to see exactly what she's seeing, maybe give or take a minute or so, is crazy. It's just unbelievable. Anyway, here's my question. It has to do with SDR radios versus traditional or analog radios. I don't know what we call them, but radios up until SDR radios. Other than the visual part of it, because I think we all know what waterfalls are by now. Other than the visual part of it, what are the differences between an SDR radio and, for lack of a better term, an analog radio, circuit-wise? What are the differences, Roy? Go ahead.
WB2EAV will comment.
Yes, Ed.
Until fairly recently, you know, an analog radio was what you know it is. An SDR radio is a computer hooked up all kinds of modules thrown across the table. But now the manufacturers are using SDR technology in radios to make kind of, look at first glance like the old boat anchors, but much smaller and with much more improved technology. And the two P's to me are the SDR-style receiver filtering, especially the CW, where you can put in any filter family you want, and direct visual synthesis, where we finally have the ultimate trip-free VFO.
Okay, that's a good explanation. Let me expand a little bit, because not all software-defined radios are the same. Software-defined radios means that some portion, as Ed mentioned, some portion of the radio is defined in software. Usually, ultimately all of them are the demodulation is done in software and the filtering is done in software. But you don't necessarily have to. And there are radios out there that are kind of, sort of, software-defined radios. Let me stop for a second. Right now, the latest, greatest method is the only analog stage of the most software-defined radio is the front end. So you have the antenna feeding into the front end, which is a broad spectrum RF amplifier, and again, this is the high end, that feeds into a digitizer. So the digitizer will take the amplified RF from the antenna and digitally encode it. then it will synthesize the in-phase I and the quadrature delay Q data stream and feed both of those into glorified computers with programs that can filter with any kind of skirt, narrow, wide, any bandwidth, without any ringing, without any problems. They're all kind of synthetic algorithms, so you don't have to worry about components or anything. And go through a demodulation circuit, and then through a digital signal processing circuit, and then finally the audio stream is output to a digital to analog audio amplifier, and it goes out your speaker or your headphone. Let me drop for a second. A analog radio basically has the same type of a front end. Once you get past the front end, it changes from kind of the ultimate software-defined radio. It then goes into the IF stages. Could be one, could be two, could be three. We sort of talked about that in the past. That will introduce a local oscillator, a mixer, and a filter, and will change the incoming carrier wave down to a standardized IF frequency. In the case of the old AM broadcast transistor radios we had as kids, the IF was 455 kilohertz. This allows you to have the amplification circuits for the transistors operate much better at lower frequencies, so you can have the higher gain with a less sophisticated electronics. Also, it allows for for inexpensive filtering, because you only have to design a filter for the IFF frequency range, and everything that you're listening to gets reduced to the IFF frequency range. Then that goes out into a detector. The detector feeds to the audio processors and amplifiers, and that goes out to the speakers. Let me drop for a second. Now, in the case of some radios recently, they do a little bit of this and a little bit of that. What they do is they have the front end, they have the IF stage, but instead of continuing on with an analog circuit, they feed the IF stage into a digitizer. And then they do all the filtering and manipulation that we know and love from software-defined radio and demodulation and what have you. So a software-defined radio can be 50% of the actual radio or 95% of the actual radio if you count the front end as 5%. So different radios, and you'll see them. They'll call themselves sometimes hybrid SDRs. When they say hybrid SDRs, they mean there's a degree of an analog system with analog stages up until usually the IF stage.
Now, does this mean by definition that a software-defined radio will easily have better selectivity and sensitivity?
Well, I mean, it sort of also depends upon your front end. Some front ends are better than other front ends, and they're all analog. So if you have a sophisticated, high-gain, highly selective, switchable front end, you get more selectivity. If you don't, you may not. The ultimate ability of the radio to work is not going to be dramatically different than a well-designed analog. What happens, though, is certainly over time, the electronics involved become relatively inexpensive as opposed to analog, component-driven devices. It's much more expensive to make large components that make up the analog legacy, and if you just switch to the digital domain, they're all solid-state devices, and if you are able to manufacture millions of them, the cost per chip plummets to sometimes pennies. So it's more of a size, efficiency, and cost. Plus, you don't have to worry the details. You could get away with a less expensive design. But, you know, it's not going to break the laws of physics, unfortunately. So the specs for a software-defined radio can be very, very good, but they're not going to be magical.
WB28.
Yes, Ed.
To answer this question a slightly different way, the sensitivity will not really change. Now, if you're talking about tuning in single sideband, you want a bandwidth of about 2.7 kilohertz, and there isn't really much change you want to do, but software filtering allows you to have steerable notches and, you know, noise cancellation and various things that can be added to it. On CW, actually can adjust the selectivity custom. There are several things. You can have the width of it, and you can move it around a little bit. And you can also still have the tunable notches. And the, when I say noise, I'm not talking about, you know, random noise. I'm talking about, like, repetitive noise, like some kind of a coherent noise that's getting in your way, but it is coherent, like ignition noise, that it can cancel that out. You do have those features, but the sensitivity itself, except for the fact that wider the bandwidth, you lose a little sensitivity because you're letting in more noise, and narrow the bandwidth to improve the sensitivity. But other than that, no real difference there. Right?
Okay, thank you, Ed. I appreciate it. Also, I have to add another layer of complication in this complicated world. There is such a thing we talked about, again, as digital signal processing. Now, you certainly can have digital signal processing as part of the software-defined radio. It's just a couple of lines of code in the firmware running the algorithm. But in addition, even legacy systems now, for the last 15 years or so, have digital signal processors. So a lot of the what we would consider to be analog radios have an audio stream that gets digitized, that gets plugged into a DSP with a series of programmed algorithms that can manipulate noise canceling, noise reduction, and it depends upon the sophistication of the DSP and the sophistication of the programmer of what you can do and what you can't do. So just to complicate matters, that even analog radios have a degree of improved digital audio filtering that weren't available to previous models in the past.
Can I go way out on a limb and start sawing and predict the future?
Would you like to?
I am serious about this.
Sure.
I have a Yaesu FD891, which is exactly the kind of design I'm talking about. That's why I bought it. I saw it, I fell in love. But here's the point. When I'm tuning around SSDs, if I hear a station that's near an integer kilohertz, I turn the dial to, like, say, 7178.000, and it's possible he has a DDS radio, and he set the dial to 7178.000. I hear him without any of the SSD distortion, clear as a bell. So I predict there's going to be a movement to the single sideband portion of the band are going to end up being on 1 kilohertz channels. So that everybody just goes to the kilohertz and takes the people up. And keep in mind, 1 kilohertz is, you know, much narrower than 1 signal. So it's not like, you know, there's any gaps. And I really think it's going to go to 1 kilohertz, and you send it to the integer kilohertz, the other guy sends it to the integer kilohertz, and finally we have clear audio.
Well, Ed, I think that's an interesting guess of the future. I kind of see people as far more pessimistically contrarian than you seem to. Although that would make perfect sense to me, and I try and keep on multiples of 1,000, because, you know, I'm just one of those guys who, you know, since I was a kid, I don't walk on lines on concrete and such. I just where there were no rules and follow them nevertheless. There are more than a few contrarians out there who, just to screw around with the universe, will pick random carrier frequencies just for the hell of it.
Well, I'm not saying it was being forced. I'm just saying all the same people who do this do much happier.
Again, I would agree, but some people don't like to be happy. I mean, right now, with my Flex, I'm able to set the steps at anything I want to. And very often, if I have well-behaved people, I set it at 1,000. Makes life much easier. I just, one click away is, three clicks or so, and I have the next conversation, and they're going on. Every so often, all hell breaks loose, and I have to set it back down to 100 cycles, because they're all over the darn place. And then there are other guys that are just somewhere in between. I think that's just their VFO acting out. It hasn't warmed up yet or what have you. But I try as best I can, because every Sunday morning I'm on 10 meters doing a 10-meter test. And I try and work that band at 10K intervals. Because it just strikes me as a lot easier than twirling them across and getting the right frequency for the person. And most people behave in rational, reasonable ways, so it works good. So I think you're right in a way. I think most people will tend to the 1,000 increment, but every so often I'll read someplace on a forum of, is it a rule that you have to go at 1,000 increments, and that's where you get the somewhat curmudgeonly response of, no, it's a free country, you could use any frequency you want.
Hey, it's a deal.
Yes, unfortunately, I didn't get that entire transmission. You want to repeat?
Alpha Charlie 2, Papa Lima.
Yeah, sure, Jeff.
although I'm not a curmudgeon, you can count me amongst the curmudgeons, at least as far as channelization of HF frequencies goes. It's not channelized, except for certain bands, as we all know. And yes, it's convenient, but, I mean, we have things like the FMT, and I'm sure, Roy, you've either read about it or participated in it, and quite successfully, I'm sure. And anyone who doesn't know about the FMT should read up on it. It's really a very, very cool thing to do. Our ability to detect on the air and decode really just about any signal at any frequency with any mode is the power, the ability of the ham. And I think that channelizing ourselves to 3K and 1K and whatever increments is turns us into a bit of appliance operators.
I think this is missing the point. It's required CDS of the whole thing is pointless.
I don't miss the point.
The point with GDS, if both stations are tuned to the exact same non-drifting frequency, SSD becomes fantastic quality. And that's the key. Without that, everything I've said is pointless and unnecessary.
If you say so.
Okay, and so lies is the nature of us amateur radio operators, that we're human beings. We have different perspectives and different viewpoints, and thankfully we could all live together and get along despite them all. As I said, there's a place for getting used to using increments, but I already know ahead of time that there are guys out there that are just, you know, they're contrary to such things. They don't want to be uniform. They want to be different, or they have a good reason for not wanting to be regimented. So each to their own. And, you know, what can I tell you, Ed? You're not going to get anyone you're not going to get a group, especially amateur radio operators, you know, 100% or even 98%, to vote that the sun is up in the sky. So, you know, human nature. It's fun.
Roy, how much of the software is open source?
It's a tremendous advantage. And no, I agree. No one has to follow it. I'm just saying, if you have gravitational capability, but you don't want to use it, no one's going to force you.
Well, we are all in agreement, hopefully. Getting back to Rich, it sort of depends upon the hardware. You get something like the very inexpensive, but if anyone wants to just toy around with software-defined radio and spend next to nothing, you know, spend approximately the same as you would on a dial phone, about 35, 40 bucks. You get an RTL dongle. They are repurposed chipsets that were originally designed for European digital television. And people have written all kinds of drivers, and you could buy them relatively inexpensive. There are limitations. They don't have great sensitivity. They work far better in microwave and UHF. And as you go down in frequency, they became practically useless. So using them for HF would probably require a converter, just to convert the base frequency up to the frequency that it has the best sensitivity to. But in those cases, there's software packages that will simply take the digital I and Q stream, kind of the very basic aspects of software-defined radio, take it into a computer, and all the rest, all the manipulation in the software, all the filtering, all the detection, all the audio processing is done modules. You can get using Linux, this software. I don't know if it's available on a Windows desktop, where it has different modules. You'll get a demodulator module. You can set the parameters for it. There'll give you filter modules. You can set those parameters. And so you can build it from scratch once you get the digital I and Q signal coming out of the dongle.
And also a 100-watt transmit amplifier is no analog.
Yes. Transmitter circuits are analog circuits.
Now, the signal source can be produced by the computer, but bringing up to 100 watts, that's analog.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of works along the same way as the audio chain is not digital at the end. You ultimately have to switch it over to analog because the audio signal that we interface with is analog and the RF transmissions are analog. Lots of luck trying to transmit a... You can modulate an RF signal with a digital modulation, but you can't... You can't just have a digital stream going to your antenna.
Boy, what would a firmware upgrade look like?
It looks like any other firmware you've ever had update. When you have your AnyTone and you do a firmware update, and it lets you make a color text instead of a single monocolor text. All it is changing the bootable software instructions to the device, and since software-defined radios are defined by the algorithm, if your radio has the space and complexity, and you give it instructions to do new things, it does new things. As I think I mentioned before, when I first bought my Flex 6700, the previous version of the firmware did not do frequency modulation. It did a CW, it did single sideband, and it did amplitude modulation. It did not do FM. When I bought it, they had just come out with the firmware update that gave the radio instructions on how to demodulate an FM signal. So, different features. New firmware could apply a whole new bunch of noise reduction algorithms. Could change the quality of controlling the filters. Make them more user friendly or such. So the hardware doesn't limit you as much as with analog. With analog, everything is hardware. You know, if you want to make a analog single sideband AM CW radio and FM radio, you have to do heavy duty surgery of putting in switches and modulation circuits. Whereas in software, you just have to define what process you're going to take the IQ bit stream through to get it modulated or demodulated in the way that you want. Different algorithms will work on single sideband, others on frequency modulation, others on CW, and on and on and on. You can theoretically program a software-defined radio to completely do, say, FT8, if you were so inclined. It just takes the proper programming.
So can somebody rewrite, for instance, Studio Flex, could somebody rewrite the software and come up with a much better radio?
AC2GS, by the way. Theoretically, yes. Practically, no, for a whole bunch of reasons. Number one, my Flex does not use a Intel chip. It uses a very sophisticated, at the time, I think it's about 8 years old at this point, field programmable gate arrays. Field programmable gate arrays are kind of fascinating chips. They're sort of software-controlled hardware chips in that they can be reconfigured using software parameters to design, to optimize a central processor type of a chip for the operations that you're interested for. So in other words, if you want to use a field programmable gate array to run a regular computer, like an Intel computer, theoretically, you would then arrange the architecture to optimize its ability to function as a general purpose CPU. If, on the other hand, you wanted to have it be a graphic processing device for 3D imaging and such, you could attempt to modify the architecture and software to configure the chip to be optimized for floating point and ray tracing and such. So it's a very sophisticated chip. Very few people understand how to program it. So that's one limitation. Number two is there's no open source for the software that the company is using. They make it proprietary. That's two. Three is there's a secure SD chip that's really secure. I cannot copy my SD card. If my SD card gets corrupted, I got to call up the guys in Texas and ask them. They're very nice. They replace it free of charge. Don't even charge shipping. But that's the only way you can do it because it's encrypted. Even if they were moderately insane enough to give me the code, since I couldn't encrypt it, it wouldn't work on the radio.
I see. So they have to go to great lengths to protect themselves software-wise. But I was just thinking, if someone can take the hardware, but you're saying it'd be nearly impossible, take the hardware that you own and rewrite all the drivers and the body of the software, could they come up with a whole new radio? You say it would be near impossible because of the proprietary nature of the chip, the CPU, and so forth.
WZ3AU, another comment.
Yes, Ed.
I have been involved with military systems where they write testing and the like, find the problem, generate a software update, close it. Here's the point. If you don't have the original source code, if you just have the final assembly code, decoding that is completely a one-way trip to the human face. I have, on occasion, been exposed to that in a very, very light manner, and it nearly drove me insane. If you had a whole program like that, the
together better.
Yeah, I would agree with you, Ed. I mean, theoretically, can you decompile something? I don't even know if you could decompile this. You'd have to kind of get into the guts and then deal with the limitations that a secure SD card enters into the equation. So just doing a core dump would probably be a major pain in the backside. Decompiling it...